Hello and welcome to the Joyful Doctor podcast. My name is Dr. Caroline Walker, and in today's episode, you'll be hearing from another inspiring healthcare professional all about managing the highs and lows of life as a caring person. Keep listening to find out how you can bring more joy into your life. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Joyful Doctor podcast. I'm really delighted actually and proud to have with me today Dr. Adrian Boyle from the Royal College of Emergency Medicine. Welcome, Adrian.
Afternoon.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Would you perhaps like to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Sure. So I'm an emergency medicine doctor in Cambridge, but I'm also, and have been for the last 18 months, president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine.
Amazing. We're really, really pleased you could come on the podcast today, because I know that those of you working in emergency medicine have had a particularly tough time of it in recent years. And we're hoping to kind of get into the meat and veg of that and what we can maybe be doing to help to improve the well-being of our colleagues in your specialty. Before we do that, though, I'd like to ask you what I ask all of my podcast guests, which is, what does it mean to you to be a joyful doctor?
So I think that I'm fairly simple. I like things to be fairly straightforward. And it means being able to go in and feel that you do something of value. It's, you know, I think there's a lot about medicine that you don't hear about necessarily. I mean, I spend most of my time about hearing about the bad stuff, but actually there is a lot of good stuff that I don't think people hear about. And going in and, you know, we all have our own bits of favorite things we like to do in medicine. I like sewing up wounds. I like relocating dislocated joints. I like taking foreign bodies out of children's noses.
I did a GP job in my first year, and a boy came in and he said, "I've got a little green man in my ear." And I thought he was joking, but he literally had this little green like toy man wedged in his ear. That was very satisfying.
Yeah, the satisfaction of doing something which and owning that whole patient journey. And somebody comes in with a problem that you fix and then send them on their way fixed. You know, I think that's, people need to enjoy that. But also the other things are working in environments where you get on well with your colleagues. Mm. You know, it's pressured, it's busy, but actually that's a lot easier to bear if you have good relationships with your colleagues.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's something we'll come back to in a moment, because that is consistently one of the factors that we find is really important for doctors' well-being, is the relationships at work and making sure that they are, you know, supportive and healthy. And could you tell us about a time when you perhaps weren't so joyful as a doctor?
Well, I fell off my bicycle and I broke my hip, my collarbone and a couple of ribs. And then I became a not-so-secret shopper of urgent and emergency care.
Oh, my goodness. You were catapulted onto the other side of the care dynamic.
Yes, I don't think we use the phrase care dynamic very often. But no, I texted a friend from the ambulance. I knew almost immediately what I'd done. And I said, you know, please do what you do normally. I don't want VIP care, because actually I think VIP care is quite dangerous. And she texted back and said, couldn't, even if I wanted to, the department's completely rammed. You're just going to have to suck it up.
Oh, wow. So long wait.
Well, when I arrived, they said, you are 12th in the queue of ambulances to be offloaded.
Wow.
Yes, it was an interesting experience.
Yeah. And I guess that probably leads us fairly neatly into, like, you know, I wanted to ask you, like, how is it for you guys in emergency care at the moment? I mean, obviously, I see people through practitioner health who are struggling, but, you know, generally on the ground, how's it at the moment?
Well, we're talking about Narnian winters, and what we've got is that, and you know, the Narnian winter is the winter that goes on forever and it's never Christmas. And the pressure from crowding and people just not moving out of our departments is persistent, and that is grinding and difficult. And people lose the feeling of agency and they feel disempowered by it. We constantly, as a specialty, come up on the GMC survey as the specialty at the highest risk of burnout.
It's not surprising to me. I mean, there's things inherent to the specialty itself, aren't there, that make it particularly challenging? You know, the unpredictable nature of the work, the high stress environment, as you say, the life and death moments. But there's also as you say now, this just increasing workload, decreasing demand, and the resources not matching.
It's interesting you say that, because everyone thinks, oh, the dealing with the cardiac arrests and the major traumas must be the bit of the job that's really upsetting. But that's not, when I talk to my juniors, that's not what upsets them. Mm-hmm. It's actually the inability to do their job properly is a much greater problem.
Actually, and we're hearing that from other specialties, yeah. The inability to give that, the kind of care that you would want to give in the time frame you'd want to give it, to access the resources you'd want to put in place for your patients. And actually, sometimes it may be like anaesthetics and surgeries, where sometimes actually that higher stress end that you might think is more stressful is actually relatively well resourced or catered for. But maybe is it more that pressure of the volume of all of the other stuff where we're just not being able to do the job we want to do?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there would be something wrong with you if you didn't get upset after, for instance, the death of a child. There would be something wrong with you to get upset about that. But the lack of inability day in, day out, just spending your time looking for a cubicle and just going, there's people I need to see. Everybody wants me to see these people. There's nowhere for me to see them.
Yeah.
Oh, and I'm being asked to go and see this patient who should have been admitted into a hospital bed 12 hours ago. And I'm being asked about to prescribe them painkillers. That just drains people.
Yeah, that kind of drip, drip, drip of like wearing you down. And that it's a bit of a moral injury, really, isn't it? On a like a little minor scale, just repeatedly over time.
Yeah. So with my juniors, I talk about that sometimes the stress in an emergency department is not because of some big major punch that hits you. Mm. It's actually like being in a boxing ring with a lightweight boxer who hits you with very fast, very light blows, yeah. And the cumulative impact of those suddenly means that you can scarcely stand up after 6 hours.
And I think there's a real parallel there with what happens with doctors who are struggling with their well-being, because, and of course we're going to talk about doctors today, but this applies to all professions across the department. It's those minor, like drip, drip, drip effect, as I say, that you don't really see, you habituate to and kind of normalize. And so you get this chronic state of being a little bit burnt out. And it's such a dangerous place to be, you know, because it's in those places where people often don't realize how unwell they've become, how risky they've become actually in terms of how safe they are to be working, and how little it would take to be like the straw that breaks the camel's back.
And over the last couple of years, we've had times, particularly during industrial action, when actually flow has improved and the level of support to emergency departments has improved and the senior decision makers are around, and actually things have worked really well. And people have remembered, oh, this is actually quite fun.
It does strike me as one of those professions that people go into because they really want to, right? They like it, they enjoy it. It's something that drives them that's really positive. Understand that you have a year or two ago you commissioned a report from a psychologist looking into the factors that might be affecting all staff well-being in emergency medicine, and thinking about some of the things we might be able to do. Could you share a little bit about that?
Yes, so Joe Daniels, who is a academic clinical psychologist working at Bath University, came to us and said, I'm interested in studying why burnout amongst emergency medicine workers. You're the most burnt out part of the workforce. What's going on? And more importantly, what can you do about it? She's got a big background in understanding occupational health anyway, but she came and spent time. She did focus groups and looked at people. And she came up, what was good about this? Everybody knows in a way what the problem is, and everyone will sit in the corner and complain about it a lot. But what she did was to articulate with a consistent narrative around what the problems were, and then also make some recommendations about it.
Yeah, and I've had a look at the report. Thank you so much for sharing it with me, and we'll share it with anyone who'd like to have a look at it. We'll put it in the show notes for the podcast, and we'll be sharing it by email and through our social media platforms as well. And it essentially came up with sort of four broad areas of recommendation, didn't it? Which was kind of, one was to change the environment to make it one in which you could thrive. One was to really look at the culture, a better culture, a kinder, more compassionate, more positive culture. Third being making sure there is a very clear pathway for support for those who are struggling. Yeah. And then finally looking at leadership and making sure that leaders have the training and support they need and the encouragement to kind of be able to role model actually a lot of the things that we the need to show our colleagues. So how, what did you think when you kind of read all of those different areas and all the different suggestions? What were you, was there anything you were particularly struck by?
Well, some of it, I think people from outside the NHS would be slightly appalled that they weren't doing this, particularly the stuff around environment. I mean, you see this every year on social media, that junior doctors, every time they turn into a hospital, there's this expression of surprise that even though that we knew this mass medical migration was going to happen, they turn up and somebody says, well, what do you mean you want a locker? What do you mean you want to be able to park? What do you mean you want to eat out of hours? We make you work out of hours, but you want to be able to eat. I mean, this is, and it shouldn't be a surprise. So some of this was just forehead slapping.
It's basic human need, food, a place to rest, you know, very basic stuff that you get.
Hygiene factors are really important. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean, what I don't mean is that the hospital needs to be clean, though often there's nothing more dispiriting than going into a grotty place. But actually, just, is this place a professional workplace where people feel valued? And, you know, things like break rooms signalling the value that a organisation puts on its staff.
And then actually that is the second point about building that culture, actually having a culture where people actually take their breaks. I mean, we just traditionally are so much worse at that within medicine as doctors compared to, say, nursing or other specialties where the breaks are almost mandated. There is a culture of, like, you take them regularly. Everyone does it. So there's that role modelling going on. How are you experiencing that on the ground at the moment? Are doctors taking their breaks? Are they being role modelled it yet? Are we, how much further have we got to go with this?
I think it's difficult. I don't think we're there yet. But that's also because we run our hospitals with so few doctors that they are stretched and they have this enormous personal responsibility. And you can see what it'd be like in somebody, a registrar who's running the department at night and says, oh, I'm going to go for my break. And somebody says, well, that's great, but we've got somebody who looks like they're about to have a cardiac arrest in Rhesus. You choose. You can see how that develops. I don't think we're there yet, but we need to have a certain amount of staff redundancy. And we can see it already. You know, we have staff rotors which don't account for the amount of people who are going to come sick leave. It is inevitable in a big organisation at any one time, somewhere between 2.5% and 7.5% of your staff will be off sick. So why not factor that into job planning? But I don't think I've ever seen that happen anywhere.
No, and it does need to happen. Absolutely. We're running at a lower staff ratio than is safe to begin with, but then factoring in all those extra factors as well. And obviously through COVID, the rates of illness were much higher at times as well. So frighteningly difficult time. How have you come through COVID? I mean, I know we're still sort of in it. We talk about it variably, don't we, as being in present tense and past tense. And where are you at with it in emergency medicine at the moment? Is it still being felt?
So I was clinical director of my department during COVID, and this is mainly entirely fashionable, but actually certainly in the first wave and when we were all getting ready, that was the time where I felt I almost had the most agency and ability to get things done of any time when I've worked in the NHS. It was like being on a big aircraft carrier and all the guns pointing one way.
Yes, and suddenly there was this permission, wasn't there, to cut the red tape a little bit and go, what do we need to do here? Let's get focused. What's the problem? What are the resources? What do we do? And I know I heard from a lot of doctors across different specialties that was a very strangely rewarding time and relieving time almost, because it kind of allowed, it really valued you. It really put you in a position to say, you are, you know, you're experts, you know what you're doing. Here's a problem. What needs to happen to solve it?
Completely. Second wave, we were in a very different situation. And, you know, you could see stuff going on at the top with the delay of the calling out of the second lockdown. Everybody could see this is coming. We're not being led well here. Everyone could see that. And I think that ties into some of the comments in the report about good leadership actually does create a better feeling with the people who are being led. And when you feel you're being badly led, people get upset.
Yeah, there was a lot of anger, I think, and a lot of mistrust. I was really pleased to read in the report across a few of the areas that they mentioned this idea of role modelling and how important that is, because I believe very strongly that is so important, that, you know, doctors do as other doctors do, nurses do as other nurses do. If we are actually role modelling that we're leaving on time or taking our breaks or getting help and support when we need it, that is one of the most powerful things we can do for our colleagues. What do you feel around that issue of role modelling, and is that something that you think is being done well in emergency medicine or could be done better?
I think it's largely done well. I think we're a relatively young specialty. So we only became a Royal College in 2015. We only became a college only about 6 years before then. So we're a relatively young specialty. And we've had a fairly rapid expansion. So the old in the specialty is 60. We do not have this long tradition of people who came from a much hierarchical environment. We're a much younger specialty. But also, I think the nature of the specialty and the point of having consultants around is you have to be approachable. And this was really brought out to me in my very first emergency medicine department. The consultants insisted on being addressed by their first names. And that was to make themselves deliberately approachable because they knew that in a safety world, there was no point not being approachable. And if they were seen as unapproachable, people would sit on things, hide things, there would be problems with the patient's safety. So that modelling around making themselves approachable was really important.
Yeah, we see that, interestingly, in psychiatry a lot. And I think it's for a very similar reason, actually, in psychiatry. We'll see people trying to encourage a bit more first name use. You know, it just engenders a sense of trust and connection and that ability to speak up when you need to.
Yeah.
I was struck by the idea of warm handovers. I've never heard that term before, and I really liked it. And I was curious to hear more. Is that something you've experienced?
Well, it's really about making sure that people feel that they're included and they are supported to access the help that they need. That actually people follow through on recommendations. So that actually, rather than just going, oh, that sounds awful, will you be okay? Going back and then just checking in with somebody a bit later.
So important. I remember very clearly a few very cold handovers in my hospital jobs, and they left me feeling completely demoralized, overwhelmed, unseen, unheard, and about to do a shift where I needed to be in the best shape possible, right? To be the best option to be for my patients. And you obviously in emergency medicine, handover is an absolutely fundamental part of your day-to-day processing, isn't it? Do you wonder if that is a point at which we could make an intervention that could have a big impact at relatively little cost?
Also, there are just basics of human behavior that you don't, if someone's made a mistake during in a handover, or they've sent a case which hasn't had, you know, where there are deficiencies in care, you don't talk about that in front of everybody else. You know, it's that praise in public, perfect in private.
And I was struck by that, the focus as well on giving positive feedback more.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be a level of accountability. And we also talk about accountability within this. Because, you know, if everybody could do all of the job wonderfully when they start up, we wouldn't need trainees.
Yeah.
People would just go off and be a consultant straight. And that's ridiculous. You know that people are going to fumble their way through what can actually be quite a complicated and sometimes conflicting and confusing environment.
I think that's often what causes problems, actually, because I think as a more senior colleague, you can comfortably say that, saying, you know, actually, we know you're going to fumble through this. We know you're going to make mistakes. It's okay. But as the junior on the other side of that, often we're looking at, you know, individuals who've been quite perfectionistic, done really well, tended not to make too many mistakes, you know, been very praise focused and can have a very catastrophic kind of outlook on what it means, you know, if I get something wrong, like if a patient were to die because of something I did or missed or, and that can be, there's often a mismatch, isn't there, between what we're hearing and what we're feeling.
Yes, but also I think there's a, you know, I think the medical schools could actually get involved in this because I think there is a need to try and teach how to manage uncertainty. So everyone assumes that my specialty is entirely following the algorithms. If somebody's having a cardiac arrest, do this. If they're having an arrhythmia, do this. But I spend an awful lot of time going, we've had a good look at you. We don't think there's anything wrong. You've turned up with chest pain. We've done an ECG, we may have done some blood tests, we may have done some x-rays. We haven't found anything dangerous. We think you're okay to go home. We're taking a judgment. And people go, oh, so what's wrong with me? And
that's hard, right?
Well, people feel obliged to give a diagnosis, but actually sometimes that's the wrong thing to do. And I see people who are harmed by being labelled. So I worked for a cardiologist. If it wasn't ischemic heart disease, everything was costochondritis. It was extraordinary. Yeah. There was nothing in between.
Something like 30 or 40% of problems that come to doctors across specialties isn't diagnosable in that way.
And I think we actually have a job as senior leaders to help people embrace uncertainty and not always feel they have to answer every question. It's the difference between the exam where you have to write down what are the causes of chest pain and you write down a big list, but actually go, there may be nothing. Would you ever put that at the top of your exam list, causes chest pain? Nothing.
We've touched on that, that idea of you kind of role modeling quite a few times in the conversation today. What do you think a typical A&E doctor could be doing to help their colleagues around them in terms of their well-being? What sort of little day-to-day actions do you think we've seen have made a difference or can make a difference?
So I don't think there's any, I don't think there's any silver bullet with this, but I do think there are markers which tell you whether a team is happy or not. You've got to remember this is a team game, and it's, I think it's important that they at least try and spend some of their non-clinical time in the department. So they spend those times up having the corridor conversations and just building that network. And I think one of the unseen things that we saw during the pandemic was everybody started working from home when they were doing their non-clinical work. And it takes time to, you know, certainly when you become a new consultant, you get that email that you don't know if it's significant or not. And if you're in an office with a number of other people, you can just say, can I just show this to you?
In GP, they call it knocking on doors, but that idea of just running something by someone or dropping in or just having that conversation in the corridor or over a coffee, or so important, isn't it? So again, it's not, it doesn't take a lot of time. It doesn't take a lot of resource, actually. It just takes that kind of building an environment where that is normalised and encouraged and role modelled.
Yeah, I would argue that, that's actually, it's an investment and a saving.
Yeah.
I think you can save people an enormous amount of time by doing this.
Gosh, I could talk to you about what you've been going through in emergency medicine and the amazing stuff that's in this report, hours. But as we kind of come to the end of our time today on the podcast, if this was your like last chance to speak with a struggling doctor or other professional colleague out there at the moment working in emergency medicine, what would you want to say to them?
Well, I'd say are struggling. It can feel completely overwhelming and they can feel that they're trapped. And actually, it is a specialty which is very, very adaptable, and people can, they can go less than full time, they can work in a different way. It is a very broad church where people can be found a home. We've seen with our senior trainees, about half of them now are working less than full time. It's something which has happened really in the last 5 years.
Yeah, well, it's happened across different specialties more and more. I think a couple of specialties were kind of ahead of the game a little bit, others are catching up. And actually, I've often thought that most doctors should be clinically at least part-time because it is such an extraordinarily demanding role. So wonderful to hear that there's that flexibility. And so I guess, you know, you're saying if somebody is struggling and feeling trapped, to remember that there are different options.
Yeah. And actually, there's over the last 20 years, you've seen this profusion of all forms of support. You know, I think we are much better at people making environment for people to come to you saying they've got a problem. And we know that frequently there are pathways that people can access, particularly for trainees, but actually within hospitals and occupational health departments, they're so much better at this than they were 10, 20 years ago. The bottom line is people really aren't alone. They may not necessarily feel that they, particularly when people are struggling, they do feel that the world is closing in on them. And, you know, almost like they're the bottom of a well. But there are lots and lots of ladders out if people are prepared to try and access
lots
them.
Lots of us that have been down the bottom of the well before and know the way out as well and can help them climb out. Thank you for that. And are there any particular resources you would recommend to your colleague?
To be honest, your biggest resources are likely to be your peers.
I like that. Yeah. The human resource.
Yes.
And actually, interestingly, I observationally over the years of working as a doctor's wellbeing specialist, the doctors I've found who have been the happiest, the wellest, are always the ones that have got a really good peer support network. And that can be either formal in terms of a peer support group of colleagues at work, or it might be just informal. It might be like a couple of colleagues you've collected over the years that you've stayed in touch with that are the people you can reach out to when you're struggling, or, you know, celebrate when you're having a good day.
And that's the sort of thing where you see all the shenanigans that were going on around the foundation program allocations, where people were being cast to rift. And actually, when I saw that, the thing that made me worry about that most is you were taking people when they were about to do a massive transition, entering the world of work into an extremely complicated, pressurized environment without out the fence. I was lucky. I did my house jobs with people that I had been medical students with. Oh. And that was actually really important.
I went to Edinburgh University, but I actually did my house jobs down in Torquay in Devon, specifically because it had been really recommended as a place with wonderful peer support and relationships. You know, everyone lived on site, people were very together in their experience, and I had a really tough time, but actually having those people alongside was extraordinarily helpful. So I guess not everybody has the luxury and or the luck to land in that position. So, you know, I'd want them to know, if you're listening to this and you think, gosh, I don't have that, that it is possible to find that and to make those connections.
And I think it's easier than it used to be. So I'm going to age myself, but 2 weekends ago, I went to my 30th medical student reunion. So 30 years out. Now, we'd all sort of lost contact 10 years ago, but with the establishment of social media 15 years ago, we were able to all reconnect. And I went to this thing, and about 70% of the year were there. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, well, these experiences we go through are pretty unique, aren't they? And they bind us, I think, in a way that nothing else can. So yeah, peer support, those relationships, nurturing those connections, making sure you're not doing it on your own. Wonderful. And if anybody wanted to contact you or find out, you know, more about the report and things like that, how would people go about?
Well, the report is on the college website. It's called the PIP study, Psychologically Informed Practice.
Development
project? Policy and practice. So it's called the PIP project. It's not snappy. So that's worth looking at.
In the notes as well for the cast.
And then I seem to have no difficulty being found on Twitter. People send me messages all the time.
Are you at Adrian Boyle or?
No, president at Arkem.
In your official capacity.
Or Arkem president, but you know, people find me and they hunt me down.
Hopefully not all bad. Adrian, that just leaves me to say thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us and for all the work that you've been doing to try and help support your colleagues in the field of emergency medicine. I'm sure the report you've commissioned will go on to help many, many, many more as well. So thank you for coming on today.
It's been really enjoyable. Thank you.
Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Joyful Doctor podcast. To find out how the Joyful Doctor can help you or any caring professionals you know, please visit joyfuldoctor.com or check out my book, Permission, How to Feel, Heal and Thrive in a Challenging World, available via our website or Amazon now.